Hey, it's you, man, from KC95 here. Good evening and welcome to Toasted Tavern. Your host, Scott Tobin, and the man called Wags are ready to bring you the night in sports. So pull up a stool, grab a drink, and let's get toasted.
And welcome in to the Toasted Tavern. My name is Michael Wags, Wagon Connect, joined alongside by my amazing co-host, Scott Tobin. Lots of stuff to talk about tonight. Scott, how are you doing, man? It's been a little bit of time since we got a chance to get together and talk sports. You with working at Busch Stadium, me with being incredibly busy with my job. But how you doing, man?
I'm good, man. I'm good. Everything's going well. I feel well. The weather's nice. So I'm doing well. How about yourself? You're not working too hard, are you?
No, not really. Can't complain too much. You know, we got concerts going on down at Hollywood Casino Amphitheater this year again, and we're providing sandwiches there. So kind of getting that to work out the way it needs to be. Plus, while, you know, still being at the store working there, and then, you know, sprinkling in the play-by-play as well. I got a chance to do a couple of professional soccer games over the weekend for Fire and Ice over there in Illinois. I got a chance to do that. So, you know, still kind of just dabbling in everything for the most part, but I was doing that, and we're going to talk about this first because it's kind of more of the immediate thing. But you got a great opportunity on Saturday while I was calling soccer to head over to Carsfield Field in O'Fallon, Missouri, home of the O'Fallon Hoots, to check out the Riz Show versus Fastlane event alongside a bunch of former Major League Baseball players doing an alumni home run derby as well. And you'll see on the screen, we got some pictures from that event. You got a chance to meet Moon from the Riz Show. You got a chance to meet BT and Stalter, who we've had on the show before, and Jamie Rivers. Talk us through how that night was, what you got to experience, who you got to meet, what you got to talk about, and just what the O'Fallon Hoots were able to do for you on Saturday night.
Yeah, first of all, like you said, we've got to give the Hoots a lot of credit for letting us have press passes, let us roaming around the ballpark on Saturday night, which is fun. And yeah, man, got to hang out. Like, you have the pictures there. Got to talk to Moon for a while. Talked to Anthony Stalter, who I've known for a while, you know, who was very cool. You know, brought over Brad Thompson and Jamie Rivers. And we stood around and talked for a little bit, and they took pictures. And that was fun. Got to run into our old buddy Ricky Ankiel for a few minutes. Talked to him for a few minutes. Couldn't get close to Ray Langford. I mean, not that I couldn't get close to Ray Langford, but, you know, he was just surrounded by kids most of the night. So I kind of let him go. But talked to Rick, talked to Riz a little bit, talked to Tony Petrenko. You know, those guys were all King Scott. Those guys were all roaming around. So it was very, very cool, man. And then, you know, you talked about the fact that, you know, the Riz Show versus the Fastlane Home Run Derby and then the alumni. But something else really cool that they did is they brought in a bunch of the amateur players, the independent league players, and some, like, club team high school kid players. And they had a home run derby as well. And then the winner of that derby, when it was over, went up against the winner of the MLB Derby, which, of course, was Rick Ankiel. And so, but it was still pretty cool. The kid, you know, what an experience for the kids. You know, they got to be out there hitting with major leaguers and talking to them in the dugout and getting advice and all of that kind of stuff. You know, it was pretty neat because just like in the MLB Home Run Derby, you know, they'd get 3 minutes and then they'd get a minute and a half. You know, and at some point, they could call a timeout. So if you imagine being one of those high school kids or an amateur player and you call a timeout and Rick Ankiel runs out and brings you a cup of water and fans you off, or Ray Langford or Raphael for call. So it was a neat experience for those guys to be able to roam around and talk to everybody. And, you know, that's such a neat ballpark in O'Fallon. You know, the fans are right on top of the field. So fans were able to come right to the edge of the dugout and talk to the guys, you know, while they were in the dugouts. And the guys got to take tons of pictures with the fans. And so that was really cool. And, you know, there were some little league teams out in the outfield shagging fly balls during the home run tournament So they got pictures taken, and, you know, and then everybody had their families there. Brad Thompson's wife and his kids were roaming around. Stalter's kids were roaming around. Ricky Ankiel's kids were running all over the place. Petrenko's kids. So it was just a really neat thing for everybody, man. It was a lot of fun. Wish you could have been there.
I wish I could have too. It was one of those things. We got in touch with the Hoots and we're like, hey, can we come out? And they were like, yes. And I looked at the calendar. I was like, no, but you know, at least one of us got a chance to experience it, and we were able to get out there and just, you know, hang out with people and really get ourselves out there again. And I loved that you and I were talking after everything was done that night, and you were just like, man, Anthony Stalter was like bro-hugging me like 3 or 4 times that night. I mean, he's been on our show once, and the reaction he has, it once again, it just goes back to what we talked about, how just we have such amazingly great broadcasters in this area and personalities, not just in the sports world, but in the radio world and the television side of things as well, to have somebody that you've met once, and I know you've probably interacted with him a lot more, but to have that kind of reaction, seeing him after not seeing him for a long time, that's something special right there.
No, yeah, it was really cool, man. You know, and you know, he's like, hey, what do you need me to do? What do you want to do? He's like, you know, call me anytime you want me on the show, you know, just very cool. And like I said, he got Brad and Jamie for me for that picture. And we stood around and talked for a while, and those guys couldn't have been nicer. You know, they both knew about the show as well through Anthony, who's kind of helped them discover us. You know, Stalter watches our show sometimes, might be watching right now. You never know. So, you know, that was really cool, you know, and they were both, Brad and Jamie were both very gracious to say they'd be willing to come on the show. So hopefully we'll have all three members of the Fast Lane at some point real soon, as well as Moon, and maybe some more surprises coming along out of that night.
Yeah, a lot of surprises from that night. And we also have other surprises coming up as well. We got some big guests lined up for later on this month that we'll unveil as soon as we get some confirmation on when they're going to be able to join us, as well as when we're going to be able to be on with our busy schedules right now. Obviously, the Cardinals are getting ready to come back in town starting tomorrow against the Reds. Another big-time series for the Cardinals. Yes, the Reds are in last place and have scuffled along for the most part this year. But as we saw just this past weekend, you cannot take some of these teams that are not playing so well lightly. And yes, they took 3 of 5 against the Cubs and they won the series, but it was not a comfortable series, to say the least. And we, you know, we talked about this last week before we got into that series, but mainly my uneasiness going into Wrigley for 5 games and not really sure what to expect. And it was all well and good to take, you know, 3 of 5, like we said. You had the game, one of the games on Saturday, the first game of the doubleheader, that Paul Goldschmidt's hit streak ended because of some very questionable umpiring, which we've seen kind of crop up a little bit more and more as the season has gone on, for sure. But then you get into Tampa after the day off and you're excited because you're going up against one of the top teams in the American League, one of the best teams in the AL East, a team though that doesn't hit amazing. You know, their top hitter was hitting in the mid 200s, their average leader. So it was a series that you went into going, okay, it could be a good test for the Cardinals. And at that point, you know, going in Monday, I'm sitting there thinking, yes, this is going to be good. And then you hear the news that Miles Michaelis and Adam Wainwright, they're going to get their starts pushed back, which is opening up a game on Wednesday for an opportunity for a pitcher to start. And, you know, and then you're thinking, you know, okay, Matthew Liberatore, it may be back up here to start. Maybe Zach Thompson gets an opportunity as well. Both those guys had some success against the Cubs. Thompson a little bit more so than Liberatore, for sure. But then that turns into a bullpen game, and we'll talk about that one here in a second. It just, after this sweep by the Rays that they completed today, it really started to get us thinking about what really is this team? What are the Cardinals this year? And even deeper than that, the money they spent this offseason, was it spent wisely? And we'll get into the breakdown of that in a little bit, but I kind of want to get your thoughts, Scott, on, you know, what you saw in that Cubs series, your mindset going into the Tampa series, and what you're thinking about right now after the sweep.
You know, the Cubs series, I'm happy with it. Yeah, you went 3-2, but you got to remember that one of those games, you did have Matthew Liberatore. You know, another game was pretty much a bullpen start. So you go into that series going, okay, there's 2 games that you very well could lose. You know, Liberatore struggled to a certain extent, although he got you through 4 innings. You know, and it was his first game in Chicago. He had no feel for his changeup whatsoever. I mean, that ball was flying out of his hand. He had no idea where that was going, which that makes it tough. You know, your third start in the major leagues, you're pitching in Chicago for the first time, and then you don't have control of one of your best pitches. That makes things kind of rough. But, you know, when you look at what the Cardinals did in that Chicago series, you come back a couple of times. You know, I mean, they hit over 300 with runners in scoring position. They had clutch hit after clutch hit in pretty much every game in that series. And like you said, you felt really good about things coming out of Chicago. And then you go into the Tampa Bay series, and you're like, eh. Like you said, you're like, man, okay. So we're going to have a bullpen game. You're going to have Michaelis, and then you're going to have Dakota Hudson. Well, Dakota goes out and pitches a hell of a game in that first game on Monday. You know, Tampa's pitching, and you knew going into that series that Tampa's strength was their pitching staff.
Yeah.
You know, them and the Cardinals basically had identical records going into that series, and you knew that the Rays' pitching has always been their strength. I mean, it always has. They've never been a good hitting ball club. Even in the years they've gone a long way in the postseason, it's never been because of their offense. And so you go into that game, your offense struggles a little bit. But then, again, I think we can start calling him Mr. Clutch. Harrison Bader comes up with the hit in the eighth inning to tie that game. You know, and so you go into extra innings and you're feeling pretty good. You know, you're thinking, okay, we get into extra innings in this thing with our lineup, I think we're going to feel pretty good. Dakota's pitched really well. You know, you get into the eighth inning and you bring in Giovanni Gallegos, who, I'm going to be honest, Gallegos makes me really nervous every time he goes on the mound this year. But Giovanni has a 10-inning pitch inning, gets you through the eighth. Okay. So you go to the ninth and it's still tied, and you don't bring Gallegos back. You only throw 10 pitches, but you don't bring him back. You go to Ryan Helsley, which was kind of a curious move. It's like, okay. So I guess Helsley's going to pitch two innings if you need him. Helsley throws 11 innings. You know, he walks the first batter. So they had two guys on base. He gets three straight pop-ups, gets out of that inning. So you're thinking, all right, so now we feel pretty good. Go to the bottom of that inning. Tampa makes a couple of mistakes. You get a couple of infield hits. Lars Nootbaar brings home a run. You're up a run. Thinking, okay, I feel pretty good. Harrison Bader then gets a hit. Paul Goldschmidt tries to score. He gets thrown out on the plate on a bang-bang play at home plate. You know, the throw beat him. Goldie really beat the tag, but just couldn't get his foot down. He just kind of – his heel just didn't come down on the edge of the base. So he's thrown out at home. So you're only got a one-run lead, and you're like, oh, man, I hope that doesn't come back to bite us. So then you go to the bottom of the 10th, and you're still feeling pretty good because, you know, Ryan Helsley's pitching. You're going to be good. Oh, wait a minute. That's not Ryan Helsley. Drew Verhagen. What are we doing? So Verhagen comes in, and, of course, the first two batters, you know, they've got the charity runner on second base. The next guy gets a hit, and all crap, and all of a sudden you're at first and third. Then he gets the next two guys out, and you're feeling pretty good. They're bringing in a pinch hitter who hasn't done anything. He gets two strikes on him, and you're thinking, all right, we're one strike. We're going to be 10 games over 500. You know, we're going to win the first game of this series. And he's got two strikes on a 200 hitter, and he throws a lollipop changeup on the inside. I mean, he might as well have just set that ball on a tee and said, here, hit me. You know, and the ball, you were praying that the ball was going to curve foul. It was going foul, but it hits the foul pole, three-run homer. Rays win, and everybody's just like, what just happened?
Yeah, you really are. I mean, you wasted another superb start from Dakota Hudson. We talked last week about how he needed to go deep in his next start. He did. He went seven innings in that start again last week, went seven innings again this time, just gave up the two hits in the earned run, struck out six. So, you know, you got what you needed out of your starter. And the fact that you kind of knew going ahead to the next game on Wednesday that you're going to have a bullpen game, it was very surprising that they used three relievers. To an extent, I mean, I think I may understand why they pulled them after 10 pitches, because maybe, you know, Ollie was thinking, okay, these guys, 10 pitches today, I can use them tomorrow now. And instead of thinking you may have lost them for Wednesday, you've got them. I get it. I get both sides of the argument, really, because at this point, if you got the ability to throw Gallegos for two innings, and maybe at that point, then you have to bring in Helsley for one. Yes, they both have pitched on Tuesday, but you've only used at max two pitchers, and you've got the whole rest of your bullpen rested and ready to go for Wednesday, which is going to be a bullpen start. But I to bring in a guy like Verhagen, who hasn't, for the most part, done a whole lot this year. I mean, just looking through what he's done this year, he is, 3-1, but a 4.96 ERA. He's struck out 11, but walked 10. He's got a blown save already. That was the blown save, but still, like, I mean, it's not like he went in, you go in thinking, okay, you need a guy to close a game out. It's Drew Verhagen. I'm not saying he's pitched poorly, but he hasn't been the most solid guy at the end of your bullpen. So you've got a lead. How are you not throwing Ryan Helsley back out there?
Yeah, I don't know. And, you know, like you said, maybe he was thinking, oh, 10 pitches, we could save him. But, you know, I could understand that, except, you know, we've seen them pitch multiple times this year where they throw 20 pitches one game, come back the next night. And I know they had the five-game series in Chicago, but they were off on Monday. So they were able to rest on Monday. You know, so you can't use that as an excuse.
And I'm pretty sure they used just 10 pitchers in that series too, which was surprising.
Yeah. You know, and then, like you said, to bring in Verhagen, you know, if you were going to bring in Verhagen, he should have been the first guy that you brought in. Bring him in right after Hudson. You know, don't bring him in to try to close out a game when he's not done it. You know, when you have a guy like Helsley who hasn't given up what he's given up two hits all year, you know, so that, you know, you really have to look at Ollie Marmol and say, okay, what the hell were you thinking there? And then, you know, to go into the Wednesday game, and, you know, I know you didn't have a whole lot of options because Matthew Liberatore got sent down because you had to bring up new pitchers, so he can't come back up for 2 weeks. So Liberatore is not available. You know, Zach Thompson pitched four innings on, what was it, Saturday Thompson pitched? So you probably weren't ready to bring him back out there yet. Probably wanted to let him rest a little bit before you threw him back out there. But, you know, when Pecky Naughton goes out and gives up three runs in the first inning, you know, and then you bring in Johan Oviedo, who, I'm sorry, I'm not sure that Johan Oviedo is ever going to be a major league pitcher, or at least not with the Cardinals. You know, I mean, he's got good stuff, but the guy can't throw strikes. You know, he hasn't progressed. We're still seeing the same version of Johan Oviedo we saw in 2020 when we first saw him. You know, it's like he's made no progression at all since then. You know, he now is tied for the record in Cardinal history for the most starts without a win in your career. He's 0-9 without a win to start his major league career. So, you know, his confidence level can't be high either because he feels like he can't win. But, you know, he was okay. He gave up a run. I actually gave up two runs, actually. But, you know, so it's 5-0. The Cardinals battle back. You score three runs. You know, Tyler O'Neill hits a home run to right field, which was a really good sign to see. Then he gets a two-run single, so it's 5-3. And you're thinking, all right, we're back in this thing. Maybe we're going to win. Okay, here we go. Bullpen's going to shut them down. We're going to win. Oh, wait, who's coming out to pitch? Is that T.J. McDonald? Is it? Is it T.J.?
Yes, McFarland? It is. McFarland, yes.
McDonald, McFarland, it doesn't matter anymore.
I mean, it's a farm now. So, I mean, you're just throwing anything out there.
I mean, that guy has been bad all year long. He pitched two innings. He gave up six runs. He forgot how many outs there were. He could have gotten out of the inning with no runs scored. The catcher's ground ball back. Bases loaded. Ground ball back to him. Kisner's literally jumping up and down in front of Hope, like waving his arms like, throw it to me. Throw it to me. He looks at him, runs over to first, underhounds it, and then pounds his glove and starts to run off the field.
I mean...
What are you doing?
Like, and that's not the only time that's happened this year. This is the second time this year that a bullpen pitcher has forgotten how many outs there were.
Not as blatant as that, though. I mean, that's just, you know, I mean, you could have been out of that inning. But instead, you know, you give up six runs. And just to put in perspective how bad the Cardinal pitching was yesterday, the only pitcher to have a 1-2-3 shutout inning in the game was Yachty, and he got a strikeout.
He did. I mean, and it's, you know, it's not something to laugh about, but it's so fucking funny too at the same time, because I mean, you pay all this money for a bullpen, and your starting catcher is the guy that had the best line score.
And just think, Yachty's ERA yesterday went from 36 to 18. And I'm pretty sure it's now better than TJ McFarland's.
It's not. Looking at McFarland's, he's got an 8.08 ERA right now. But still, I mean, with the amount of innings that Molina has pitched versus the amount of innings McFarland's pitched, theoretically, it probably is better. And you're also sitting there going, Albert's probably sitting there going, man, I cannot wait to our next blowout because I got to get my ERA lower too.
You know he's thinking that. He's not going it's going to be a competition. They're going to be begging to pitch the rest of the year.
They certainly are. Well, I mean, Tampa Bay's offense definitely came alive in that game, mainly because of the fact that the Cardinals pitching staff allowed them to. You know, you looked at, you know, Randy Arozarena had a great game. He had four RBIs in that game. And, you know, I'm a little surprised, though. I haven't heard, and I guess maybe it's because the outfield has kind of settled to a point where we're good with what we've got. But even after having that big game, you know, scrolling through Twitter and social media and all that stuff, did not see a whole lot of, oh man, why did we trade Arozarena away or anything like that. I didn't really see any of that. Are we at that point where fans are now comfortable with the outfield that they have and they're like, okay, that's okay, we'll let that one go? Or is it more so just the fact that the pitching and bullpen was so terrible in that game, people were just bitching about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think Randy Arozarena has come back to earth. You know, I mean, he's not the player that he was in the postseason a couple of years ago. you know, going into that game yesterday, he was hitting like, what, 260 with six home runs and 24 RBIs. So, you know, I mean, Tyler O'Neill missed 3 weeks and has almost as many RBIs as Randy Rosarena does. So, I mean, I think people are comfortable with their outfield now. I mean, when you see what Harrison Bader is doing on a regular basis, and you see we're seeing glimpses that Tyler O'Neill might be on the verge of being last year's Tyler O'Neill again. Yep. And then, you know, Dylan Carlson, I think everybody knows is going to be a pretty good ball player. And then you look around and you go, okay, we've got – and then you look and you go, okay, and then we have Oviedo and we have Donovan and you've got Newt Barr who's looked okay and you can – you know, you've got all these other people coming. You know, so I think people are finally okay with it. And, you know, we'll see. You know, and then going into today's game real quick.
Yep.
You know, hour and 56-minute game. Both pitchers were on their game. You know, Miles Michaelis pitched a complete game and lost, you know. Gave up three hits. Unfortunately, two of them were in the same inning. Gave
up one of them went over the fence.
Yeah, gave up a infield single to Kevin Kiermaier, and then right,
yeah, the 2-run home run by Jimon Choi
to Smiley, as I used to like to call him. But yeah, Kiermaier, the little Kiermaier infield single kind of was the bad one in that inning because he beats it out, and then Joyce hits the home run. And, you know, the Cardinals are only able to muster one run, you know, on a throwing error by the pitcher.
Yeah.
Although they had a couple of chances. I mean, Yepes, they hit some balls hard today. I will say that. They hit three or four balls hard that just happened to be right at outfielders, and the Rays made really good plays. And, you know, things just weren't going their way. You know, it happened today. It happened in last night's game when the game was 5-3. Yepes hit balls today and yesterday that were just absolute bombs, but they died right at the wall. Left fielder just happened to catch them. And those things happen. So, you know, it's disappointing that you didn't win that series. You should have won the first game. You know, you were hoping you could take 2 out of 3, win that first one, and then get today. But it didn't work out, and you move on. And, you know, I know a lot of people are overreacting, going, oh, man, see, this Cardinal offense is horrible. But you got to remember, you know, you went into it, you played a really good Tampa team, and a team that you see once a year. You know, and sometimes it's a couple of years before you see these pitchers. So, you know, yeah, they struggled because they saw guys they haven't seen. You know, some of the new guys have never seen Tampa, never played in that ballpark. So, you know, and the Rays have an advantage playing in that park with the AstroTurf and the bad lighting and everything else. Even though there were more Cardinal fans there than there were Rays fans, it's still an advantage for the Rays because it's a different ballpark than anything else in Major League Baseball. So, you know, it was just one of those series. You just shake it off and say, okay, we got to come home and beat up on the Reds and Pirates now. And part of the reason you can shake it off is because Milwaukee's really struggling. And you lost no ground in the standings. You're still a half. Well, I don't know how the Philadelphia game ended today. It was tied last time I saw.
Milwaukee ended up winning that one, 8-3, right. Okay, or 8-4, something like that.
So you're back to a game and a half out. So you're pretty much where you were on Sunday. So you know, I mean, you didn't really lose any ground over the weekend.
Game out. Not even a game and a half. It's a half game.
So Milwaukee must have lost.
They got swept by the Phillies. We are sitting Cardinals are sitting a half game back right now.
Okay, I misunderstood you. I thought you said Milwaukee won.
Oh no, sorry. Yeah, Philly won 8-3.
Okay, so you lost no ground in these 3 days. Yeah. So you're in good shape, you know, because now you've got Cincinnati and Pittsburgh, 7-game series at home, and you should be able to win. Although we don't know who's going to pitch tomorrow, which is
Right now, it's listed as Andre Pallante. You know, he's done well out of the bullpen. He started, Sunday. In Chicago, against the Cubs. So, but once again, that was another piece that came up was, you know, because Pallante started on Sunday, it made his availability in the bullpen null and void for the first couple of games here. Potentially starting tomorrow also takes him out of that bullpen as well. And he'd been one of those mainstays to come out and really kind of shut things down. So, once again, it just goes back to the fact that, A, you've talked about all this depth with the pitching that you have, at least in the starting, and yet you still have bullpen games that you're throwing out there. You know, we don't know what Dallas Keuchel is going to be like down in Arizona, but you had an opportunity to possibly go out there and sign a Dallas Keuchel to maybe at least fill a void. Or, hell, you could have done something else in the offseason because right now Steven Matz, your big marquee signing, is still injured. He had a setback in his recovery as well, so no telling when he's coming back. Jack Flaherty goes out on a rehab tomorrow, still a couple weeks away from him coming back. So it just, once again, it begs the question, you know, the money that they spent this offseason, was it spent wisely? Because it's, you know, going through the list of, you know, the amount of money that they spent in the offseason, it's not as much as you think. And I think that's the whole thing is people, a lot of people think, oh, they spent a ton of money, but they didn't spend it correctly. Or, you know, they didn't spend enough money. It's not a whole lot that they spent. I mean, Mats was the big offseason signing, 4 years, $44 million. You know, you brought back Wainwright at 17 and a half. You brought Molina back at 10. You brought Albert back at 2.5. The fact you have Albert Pujols at $2.5 million should tell you all you need to know about the fact that they didn't necessarily spend a ton of money in the offseason. And then you got, you know, Bader extended for 10.4. Verhagen signed for 5.5 over 2 years. Dickerson at $5 million. You had McFarland at 2.5. You re-signed Gallegos to 2.4. And you signed Nick Wickering for 1.2. So they didn't sign these guys for a ton of money. And now you're looking at it going, and I think most people looked at it going into the off, into the regular season as well. It's like, yeah, you spent money. You brought in a lot of bodies. But did they bring in the right guys because and spend the money the proper way? Or is this just continuously Mo's MO that he will bring in guys to say he brought them in, but not necessarily the right ones for the right amount of money?
Well, okay, let's look at it real quick. So, okay, we can say – you know, T.J. McFarland, everybody was begging for the Cardinals to bring T.J. McFarland back because he had such a good year last year. So, you know, you say, okay. And he may still turn it around. The one thing you can look at yesterday, as bad as that was, everything was on the ground, which is what he needs to be to be successful. So, there, as bad as yesterday went for him, there is that to look at, that at least he's throwing, getting ground balls again. Maybe that is a sign of something. You know, Nick Wickren, $1.2 million. He's not been bad. And, I mean, let's look at it this way. Do you want to pay the $1.2 you gave him? Or do you want to spend the, what, $7 million that the White Sox gave Joe Kelly? And they want to run Joe Kelly out of Chicago.
Yeah.
So, you know, we all know how relief pitchers work. You know, 1 year you're really good. The next year you may struggle. It's kind of a crapshoot when you sign relief pitchers. I mean, that's just the way that field works, man.
That's how McFarland and Garcia came to this team last year.
Right, exactly. You know, so those you kind of look at and go, okay, the Albert thing, 2.5. I don't think anybody can look at Albert and say that's money poorly spent because, yeah, he's not hitting right-handers, but he's still, when you break down his numbers, he's still on pace for 50 RBIs by the time the season's over. He's still on pace for about 14 home runs at 162-game pace. If you get 14 and 50 out of Albert, you know, doing what he's doing and he hits, you know, I'm going to assume before it's over, he hits 230 or 240 probably, taking his left-handed and right-handed splits. If you get that out of Albert Pujols at 41 years old, I don't think you can complain about that. Plus, we've talked about what he brings to the clubhouse, which is and to these young players, which is way more valuable than anything else he's doing on the field. So I think that's fine. Corey Dickerson's been a disappointment. But I don't think anybody looked at Corey Dickerson and thought, okay, $5 million for a left-handed bat, you know, that might not be that bad of a deal. You know, and of course, Corey Dickerson finally hits his first two home runs of the year and then he gets hurt. So, you know, I mean, he's got two homers and what, 11 or 12 RBIs in the amount of time that he's played. So while he hasn't done exactly what you want, I mean, I don't think he's been horrible, you know, considering he hasn't gotten a lot of playing time because you want these young kids to come up. So I think that begs the question, okay, so if you didn't want to spend money on Albert and you didn't want to spend money, or if you wanted to spend more money than Albert and Dickerson, who are you going to spend it on? Were you going to spend it on Kyle Schwarber, who has 10 home runs but is hitting under 200 in Philly? Nick Castellanos, who's not been very good in Philly? Or do you want to see what Nolan Gorman can do, who's brought a spark to this team, and Juan Yepes, who's brought a spark to this team, and Brendan Donovan, who's brought a spark to this team? So I don't know that you can complain about that. If you're going to complain about something, I guess you could say they could have gone out and gotten another starting pitcher, which I wanted them to do. I don't think Steven Matz was a bad deal. I mean, Matz for 4.46 or whatever it was that he got, 45. You know, that was pretty reasonable. Coming off a really good year in Toronto last year, you know, I don't think that was a bad deal. I mean, you know, he's had injury history in the past, so that was a risk you were going to take. But, you know, for that money, it's not bad. I mean, you could have given Marcus Stroman a whole lot more money. But, you know, Stroman wasn't good in Chicago the other day when the Cardinals saw him. You know, and he hasn't been real consistent. So, I think you took a shot, and we'll see. Maybe Max can come back and be better in the second half. You know, the Jack Flaherty thing is the thing that's really killing him. You know, the fact that when they knew Flaherty wasn't ready, and they didn't do something else there. You know, I mean, to keep saying, "Oh, he's going to be a month. Oh, he's only going to miss a couple of weeks. Oh, he's fine. It's nothing." You know, anybody that knew, you know, I came on this show and threw a fit when they said that and said, "There's absolutely no way he's pitching for at least a couple of months." And anybody that's telling you he is lying to you. You know, and I mean, and everybody in the media was saying, "Oh, it's not that bad. He'll be back in a couple of weeks." No, he won't. You know, and we still don't know. You know, hopefully he'll be back in a couple of weeks now. You know, he's thrown 30 and 45 pitches in his two rehab starts so far. You know, and they're going to jump it up 15 every time he pitches. So hopefully in 3 weeks or so, maybe we see him here. But, you know, you got to get through the next 3 weeks. And, you know, Dallas Keuchel might have been your best shot to bring anybody in right now, because you're not going to make a trade, right? Nobody's making a trade right this second.
No, they're not.
You know, it's the exact same spot we were in last June, honestly, which, you know, was Mo's whole selling point. Oh, we're going to go bring in a bunch of guys because we're not going to deal with what we dealt with last year. Well, guess what? Here we are. So, you know, you just got to hope that they can piece it together. You know, maybe, you know, I don't know, maybe Zach Thompson gets a start here or there. He looked pretty good in his relief appearance in Chicago. You know, you got another week and then Libertor can come back up here. You know, he's had a couple of good starts. You know, he had two good ones and one in Chicago. So, I mean, I think you give him another shot and see what he can do. It amazes me, though, how people overreact. I don't know. And I'm going to throw him under the bus here, and then hopefully they're not watching, but our friends over at, and, you know, sometimes I take shots, but BK and Ferrario had decided yesterday that they've given up on Matthew Libertor, that he's not the prospect. After three starts, they've decided that they can tell he's not a number one starter and he's maybe a middle of the rotation pitcher. Now, seriously, three starts? You're a 22-year-old kid who's had three starts. You're going to decide that he's not the future of your pitching staff? Really?
Yeah, I don't see how that's even a question mark, because, you know, yeah, maybe they're looking at the trade and trying to grade the trade that maybe he should have been here earlier and making an impact now, but the trade, I think, has been pretty even for the most part. I mean, he is tearing it up in the minors, and he's getting more progressively towards Major League Baseball. And like you said, two of his three outings have been okay. One was really good. I mean, I think his second start was exactly what you wanted out of him. And then, like you mentioned earlier, going into that, it's the first start in Chicago. We talk about how it just sucks going up and playing in Wrigley Field anyway. Then you get your first start, and you said fighting control and stuff like that. It's going to happen. But, yeah, I don't think you can necessarily give up on him right now. And he's going to be able to – if he gets a chance to be up here and take some time and be under an Adam Wainwright's wing for the rest of the season, that's going to be a huge boon for him. Being, you know, I'll even say it, I think being under the wing of Miles Michaelis isn't a bad thing either, because you've seen what he's put himself through to get back to where he was his first year here. I think Miles Michaelis has probably been the best pitcher for the St. Louis Cardinals this year. Dakota Hudson's starting to creep up there. I think it's Michaelis, Hudson 1-2, and then Wainwright right after that. That's how I feel it sits for me right now. So having those two guys to learn from, the fact that he hasn't been up here, he hasn't gotten a chance to experience that, especially with the shortened spring training that they had this year. So that's the crazy thing. And, you know, kind of going back to what they did in the offseason, there are names that were thrown out that, you know, people, including ourselves, that, you know, we wanted the Cardinals to take a look at least in the starting rotation wise. You know, Zach Greinke, 0-4, 5.05 ERA. Stroman, like you said, 2-5 with a 5.32 ERA. John Gray, 1-3 with a 5.28 ERA. So the Cardinals are not the only team that are seeing pitchers struggle. And I think it's not so much that you have to look at the money spent, but the fact that they lost so much of spring training that these guys are still trying to work themselves into regular season shape.
Yeah, I agree. The one guy that we really pitched for at the end of spring training, we wanted him to go get, and they didn't do it, is actually tearing it up. And that's the guy that the Padres pulled the trigger on. Sean Manaea has been absolutely – he's been the best pitcher in that Padre rotation.
Yeah.
You know, that's the guy the Cardinals should have tried to go get. You know, they thought they had enough, or that you know, Flaherty was going to be back, or they'd convince themselves that they didn't need it. But that's the one that, of all those guys, that's the guy you look at and go, man, they missed out there. That's the one they should have gone and gotten. And you hope it doesn't happen at the trade deadline. I mean, they have to. And you're hearing people, in, not just in St. Louis, but nationally say, you know, you've got to go get a pitcher, because you look at this ball club and you look at the National League, look what they were, look where they were going into Tuesday night in Tampa. They were only a couple of games behind the Dodgers and the Mets for the best record in the league. This is a good ball club. People in St. Louis don't want to see that. The national media has picked up on it, and they're talking about the fact that this is a good ball club. But this is a good ball club. You know, you get another pitcher or two in that rotation and kind of shore up the bullpen in a couple of places, and this team is going to be really tough to beat with that defense and the way they play baseball. The little things like they did in Chicago with, you know, the hit and run and the clutch hits and the stealing bases and running the bases and their defense. I mean, how many runs did their defense save in Chicago over the weekend? You know, I mean,
and a handful at least.
You know, and those are the things that are going to win you games when you get into September and October. And so, you know, let's just pray that Mo is looking around, because there are going to be some pitchers, you know, at the trade deadline that you could potentially go out and get to bring in and be, you know, are you going to get an ace? I don't know. But if you could go get a guy to slot in behind, you know, if you get another guy that you can slot in behind Flaherty and Michaelis and in front of Waino and Hudson, and you have that, you know, you're in really good shape. And, you know, you could go out, if you're going to do that, you know, a guy that, you know, we threw a thing on the page that there's been some speculation about Madison Bumgarner. And I know, actually, I was surprised, because most of the people that commented were in favor of Bumgarner. I think, you know, I mean, if you're talking about going into the postseason, I can't think of a pitcher you would rather have in a big game in the postseason than Madison Bumgarner. I mean, that's when he's shined his whole career. He's been a better postseason pitcher than a regular season pitcher. But then there's also going to be some, you know, guys that you could look at and say, okay, maybe they're potential aces. You know, Frankie Montas in Oakland is going to be out there. He's thrown a lot of innings. You know, he's been decent with a bad team in Oakland. And then the guy that, man, if you could figure out a way to do this, and it's just rumor and speculation, but if somehow you can pull a trade with Cleveland and you could get Shane Bieber on this ball club and put him in that rotation, I mean, that would be – there's your ace. Then Jack Flaherty – then you slide everybody down, because then it goes Bieber, Flaherty, you know, and then you
Michaelis,
can decide
Matz,
Wainwright, Michaelis,
yeah.
Hudson, Matz, whoever you want to throw in there after that. But you've got that 1-2 that you've been looking for. You know, that would be the thing. You know, a lot of people are saying, oh, well, maybe Quintana from Pittsburgh or Castillo from the Reds. I can guarantee you that neither one of those teams are trading their best pitcher to the Cardinals.
No, not interdivision. And I just, yeah, I can't see that being the case. And going back to your point on Bumgarner, you know, he is the perfect prototype for a Cardinal pitcher in a sense. He's a bulldog. He's a country boy. He fits the mold of what a Cardinal pitcher of the past would be. He's the Chris Carpenter of Major League Baseball in a sense right now. And yeah, maybe he's not having the greatest. He didn't have the greatest of seasons of last year, and he hasn't started off well this year, but you get a change of scenery into the historic Cardinal uniform, a team that he knows the franchise very, very well. You know, he knows the history of the Cardinals. They've had battles when he was with the Giants. He knows what it's all about. You get him in here in October with the rally flags going, the playoff bunting on the walls, I guarantee you Madison Bumgarner will be a pretty good piece if you have him in your bullpen at the very least, because I don't think you'll put him in as a starter. I think you will use him in the bullpen in the moments that you need him to be used, and he will shut it down. I saw people on our post that were like 100% against it, but I just, like you said, I don't see how you can't at least explore that option. And if the price is right, I mean, you've already spent money, you know, on guys that aren't doing it right now. Why not bring in a guy that has a proven track record and give him an opportunity? And if you're talking about Bieber, I would love to see Shane Bieber on here, mainly because he's on my fantasy team. And I think coming to St. Louis would only make his fantasy numbers that much better. And then it takes the pressure off of Flaherty to be the number one coming off of injury. And like you said, it slots guys down and gives you a lot better matchups as well when you're facing other teams. You know, it's just like hockey in a sense. if you can get your top guy matched up against one of the lower tier pitchers and your better guys against lower tier pitchers, all of a sudden everything is better for you.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, two more pitchers that we didn't just talk about that, you know, they've been rumored they may be available. Although since the Phillies just swept the Brewers, that might not be the case. There's been some talk that Aaron Nola may be available, which that would be another guy that would be a top of your rotation guy. And then the other guy who might be available, stop me if you've heard this name in Cardinal trade rumors before, Kyle Gibson could be available.
I've never heard that name before. Ha, 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 ha.
You know, a guy who lives in St. Louis, we know St. Louis area, would love to be, you know, back with the Cardinals, has lots of friends on those teams, has friends in the area, knows people on radio in St. Louis, knows people possibly talking to you right now in St. Louis.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, one of those guys could be interesting. And Kyle Gibson would be a nice piece. You know, again, he wouldn't be that ace, but he's that guy that you put in as your third or fourth starter, and you roll him in the playoffs, and you'd feel pretty good about it.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right on that. So we'll see how that plays out. And before we get off the Cardinal subject here, is like I said, we've got a ton of stuff to talk about tonight. You know, we're past the quarter pole of the season. Obviously, Memorial Day is kind of that post that you look at and, you know, look at standings and things of that nature. But after the Chicago series and especially that game one doubleheader against Chicago, I kind of want to get your feel on where you think Ollie is at right now. I mean, if you had to give Ollie a grade on his first season here, all things considered, where do you think his grade is at right now?
I'd probably put him at like a B- right now. That's probably where I'd have him. And some people might think that's a little low. Some people will say it's high, but I think for the most part, he's done a good job. I've got a few questions about some of his bullpen moves. Like, you know, I mean, that happens with every manager. But I think that's where my biggest question is some of the decisions he's made with the pen. But other than that, I think for the most part, he's done a pretty good job. You know, he's done a nice job with lineup construction, I think. So, yeah, I think B- right now, with a definite chance for it to go up as we get into this later in the season.
And see, that's exactly where I am at as well. And it is mainly because of bullpen management. And the issue I think that arises from that is the fact that it's with every manager, but it seems like you're having the same sort of issues. You had it with Schilt. You had it with Matheny before that, where it seems to be almost the same kind of bullpen issues are creeping up every year with this team. And you can't even go back and say that La Russa was the best at it, because, I mean, yeah, he did invent the modern bullpen and things of that nature. But even just today, you know, La Russa kind of messed up his bullpen in a sense and, you know, intentionally walked a guy with two strikes only to have Max Muncy come up and smack a three-run homer. So, I mean, yeah, bullpen issues are a manager's worst nightmare. But I think that is the main reason why it's in that BB- category for me, is because we're seeing the same sort of bullpen mismanagement that we've seen in the previous two managers still creep up with Ollie. But I think he's a guy that will learn. And I think that's the difference is, you know, Matheny was raw when he came in, and I think he has learned a little bit. I mean, he's not doing great in Kansas City, but he's got a young team. So I think he's still growing. The one that got me was Schilt, the fact that he had spent so much time with the organization and around baseball, not playing, but around baseball. That's where the bullpen mismanagement kind of got me a little bit. And I can see why Ollie is in that same mold, because he was the bench coach for Schilt. So it's more so a matter of him figuring out his style and how it all fits. But his tirade on Saturday was epic. One of the best manager, you know, blow-ups we've seen in a while. And I think that really endeared him again to Cardinals fans, that here we got a young, fiery manager that knows the game, has good connections with his players, but will also allow his players, especially his veteran players, to kind of lead the charge as well and not, like, try to ruffle any feathers. He's just – right now he's exactly what the Cardinals need. I don't know if long-term it's who they need, but in the moment, this is the kind of manager that this team needs.
Yeah, and, you know, I think something else that the Cardinal fans like is, you know, he's really willing to come out and say, okay, this was bad. You know, he doesn't – that's what drove people crazy about Schilt is – no matter how bad the game was, you know, everything was rosy when he would talk about, oh, you know, saw a lot of good effort here, this and the, you know, and I would be like, yeah, I screwed that up, or he wasn't good tonight, or, you know, we've got to do that better. And those are things that Cardinal fans want to hear, because they can see it. Mm-hmm. You know, they want to hear, hey, we got to fix that. Not, oh, it's going to be fine. There's nothing to see over here. Look over here. Everything's fine. which is what Schilt tried to do a lot, which drove fans crazy. You know, Ollie's very straightforward and says, hey, here's what's going on. Here's what we're going to do. And this is how it is. And so I think that's really endeared him to Cardinal fans as well.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right. So Cardinals get underway tomorrow night against the Reds. It's going to be a big series for them. I feel like they have to sweep to really not necessarily make people feel better, but it's the Reds, so you better sweep them. The one game that will be tough will be the Sunday game. You know, the guy going for the Reds that day, Graham Ashcraft, a 3-0 record, a sub-2 ERA. So it's going to be tough, but he's going up against Dakota Hudson. That's going to be probably a very, very well-pitched game. So make sure you check those games out. Also, if you're down there, find Scott, because he's going to be down there. He works at Busch Stadium for game days, so make sure you check him out.
Real quick, public service announcement for all of the ushers working at the ballpark this weekend, especially tomorrow night, that are working out promotions and giveaways. It's Yachty Wainwright Mystery Ring Night. Just take your ring, be happy with it. Don't complain and drive the ushers crazy and want to change and want to know why you can't have this. And why? Just be happy. You're getting a ring. Whether it's the 06 ring, the 04 ring, the 13 ring, the 11 ring, they're all either National League Championship or World Series rings. Be happy. Don't drive the poor ushers crazy, because that can be very taxing for those guys. I feel sorry for the giveaway ushers a lot of nights, because a lot of nights it's very stressful on them.
Well, and it's going to be hot too. So add that into it as well. So, oh boy. All right. Yeah, definitely check out those Cardinals games. All right, let's switch over to the NHL real quick. Obviously, Stanley Cup final playoffs are going on right now. Colorado has advanced to the finals. You've got Tampa and the Rangers underway here in game 5. That series is tied at 2. Rangers took the first 2 at home. Lightning took their 2 at home, and they're in New York tonight. Ryan Reeves not in the lineup for the Rangers, which may not be what Rangers fans want to hear, because I think he's a guy that, just like Pat Maroon for the Blues, is the glue that kind of keeps that team together. And with Tampa Bay kind of asserting control over the last 2 games, not having a guy like Reeves in the lineup, this may be bad news for the Rangers.
Yeah, the Rangers got Ranger fans excited. Ooh, 2-0. We're in good shape. Oh, wait. No, we're not. Here come the Lightning. I'm not feeling good about the rest of this series, I'll be honest. At least they didn't get swept, which is something the Blues fans should feel good about, because the Blues are the only team that put up any resistance against Colorado in the West in the postseason.
Yeah, the only 2 games that Colorado lost in the Western Conference playoffs was against the Blues. They swept the Oilers, which I don't think was much of a surprise, especially with Mike Smith in goal. Take pride in that. And the fact that you took 2 games, and it was because it was after Jordan Binnington left after one of them. So that's something you should definitely be thinking about going into this offseason. And Doug Armstrong met with the media just the other day as well to talk a little bit about, you know, his thoughts on the offseason. And remember, you have to always take this with a grain of salt, because it's a GM who's trying to have a poker face. And of course, he's always going to say the right things and the good things about the team. And, you know, he feels like this team's in a good spot. They've got a couple of free agent decisions to make. Obviously, Billy Husso, Nick Leddy are up for free agency, as is David Perron. It sounds like, from everything I heard, that David Perron is the priority, and then they'll see where everything else falls from there. It'd be nice to get Nick Leddy back here, but I feel like it's going to take some moves for that to happen. And that's reading between the lines and listening between the words of Doug Armstrong. That seems to be what he was saying as well, as it's, we're going to get Perron done, and then we're going to see what we can do to move people around to get others back into this lineup. And I don't think they're going to be too terribly aggressive in moving people around, because, you know, you've got guys like Jake Neighbors and Zach Boldick that are down in the minors that are playing very, very well. And, you know, Boldick got moved up to the Thunderbirds, who are in the Calder Cup semifinals. So they've got a lot of promise in the minors, and I don't necessarily think they're going to be too terribly aggressive trying to move people around to get some of these free agents in outside of Perron. July 13th is that start of free agency. And one final thing that Doug Armstrong kind of tiptoed around, I guess, was the question about Tarasenko. You know, he was obviously ecstatic about what Vladdy did this year. He's not concerned about Tarasenko next year as far as what he can bring to this team, but he stops short of committing to not trading him or even talking about the potential trade request that he had out there as well. So you've got that question still kind of hanging over this team. Do you feel, you know, what transpired this season, you know, kind of ended that question of Tarasenko going anywhere? Or do you think they may think about moving on from him?
Well, here's the $100 million question. The fact that he didn't commit to Vladdy and Vladdy's $7.5 million, how much of that has to do with Vladimir Tarasenko? And how much of that has to do with, hey, let's look around and see if we can get that guy that we said we were going to talk about, and we can make that trade may happen? Because if that trade happens, then you've got to move Vladdy and that money. So how much of that, how much of those two things are interlinked?
I think it's right there. I think that's why he didn't totally commit, like you said, because those options are still there. You gotta have the poker face. You've got to say what you got to say, but you can't say what you maybe need to say or want to say. And Armstrong's been phenomenal at that. I mean, obviously we should not discredit the fact that he didn't talk about Ryan O'Reilly before he made the move. We had no idea Justin Falk was going to be traded to the Blues. He's done a really good job of hiding and disguising what he's been doing. So, yeah, this might be another one of those instances where he's already talking to Calgary, and some of these guys' names have already come up. And he's like, we're great. We think they had great years. We're not concerned. We're good going forward. And then 2 weeks later, the man who will not be named is on the Blues all of a sudden because Doug Armstrong's worked his magic again.
Yeah, it's very possible. The other thing I want to ask you about, David Perron, and you know that they've said that is kind of the main point. That's the guy you got to go get. How concerned are you, though? Because we kept hearing, going as the season ended, the Blues want to bring David Perron back, but they're probably going to want him to take a little bit of a pay cut. And then in the last couple of days, you're starting to hear rumors that Perron's looking for somewhere between $5.5 and $7 million. If that's the case, can the Blues do that?
I think they have to. I mean, if you saw Perron declining over the last couple of years, I'd say, you just say, hey, this is what we'll offer you and walk away. But Perron's gotten stronger over the last couple of years. He was one of the better players this year. He was great in the playoffs. It almost seems like he found a fountain of youth kind of this past offseason because he did not play like Alex Steen was at the end of his career. And that's not to take anything away from Alexander Steen because he was the right guy for this team at the right time. And he put in so much effort, and the fact that he got to experience what he got to experience with this team, winning the cup and all, he's not that Alex Steen. Alex Steen was declining at the end of his career. I think David Perron is still not at his peak, but he's a very smart hockey player at his age right now. And I think you almost have to sit there and say, okay, we're going to have to suck it up and pay him $5.5 million to come back for the next 2 years, maybe. And yeah, maybe in a cup, maybe next year or the year after, he's down that third or fourth line at $5.5 million, but that's where Alex Steen was at when they won the cup. And David Perron is a smart player, and I think he fills that role very, very well. Now, if you look at sit there and say $7 million, no, $7 million is not going to happen. But I think in my heart of hearts, both the Blues and David Perron know that David Perron is coming back to the St. Louis Blues. And yes, maybe it is at a bit of a pay cut to what he is looking for. But if you're Perron's agent, you have to ask for that because right. Some team may go out there and say, yeah, we'll pay you $9 million to come in here. And at that point, I would sit there and go, David Perron, thank you, but go get that money, man. Go get right. your $9 million from some team. But right. I still think it'll end up happening where they find a way to make it happen and get him re-signed here because he's never signed a contract with any other team except the St. Louis Blues. And I really don't want that streak to end. I think he's magic here. And it's perfect for both parties.
Yeah, no, I agree. The only thing that would worry me, is the fact that he is getting a little bit older and, that concussion history always has got to be a little bit in the back of your mind. He dealt with that a little bit this year. Yep. He had a concussion and then kind of struggled for a while. And people are like, what's wrong with Perron? He's not doing anything all of a sudden. It took him a while to kind of bounce back. So that kind of worries me just a little bit. And then the conversation we just had where you're like, I think everybody knows that he's coming back. It's magic. It's meant to be. It's eerily familiar of conversation we had 2 years ago when we were talking about Alex Pietrangelo. I'm just throwing it out there.
You're right. But here's the thing, though. The only reason Alex Pietrangelo didn't resign was because of the no movement clause. David right. Perron's not going to ask for a no movement clause. Doug Armstrong is no way in hell going to give him a no movement right. clause. But I mean, that really was the only thing that prevented from, you know, Pietrangelo from coming back was the no movement clause. So yeah, I get you though. I mean, you can talk all rainbows and sunshine all you want. It's still a business and things are still going to happen. And like I said, if a team does walk down the street and offer him $7, 8, 9 million, I'm not gonna sit there and say, David Perron, don't take it, because you got to set your family up. And you also have to remember, Players Association is going to be in on that as well. You know, if a team does come down and offer you that kind of money and you sit there and turn around and say, oh, I'm not going to take that, but I'm going to take 4.5 to stay here, that really messes with the pay scale of players. Yes, the cap is, it's a hard cap this year and we know the number, but there's still, you have to have that factor in as well. Yeah, maybe he doesn't take the $8 million here, but maybe it forces the Blues to have to pay 6.5 or something like that as well. So yeah, it's a tricky subject and it's a tricky thing, and that's why I'm not an agent, nor am I a player or a general manager, because I probably don't know enough about that to help make a decision.
Well, you know what'll happen? He'll go sign somewhere for like $8 million.
He'll get traded back here.
Then that team will struggle. He'll get traded back here. The Blues will only have to pay the prorated part of his salary. And they'll pay like $4 million for David Perron to come back.
Probably will. Oh, man. Probably will. Well, there is still Blues prospects playing. The Springfield Thunderbirds, as we talked earlier, are in the Eastern Conference Finals. They're up 2-1 over Lavelle. Will Bitten, 4 goals in Game 3, 6-3 victory. So not even any of the big names. But he was actually a former Rocket. The Rockets traded him to Springfield, and he comes back and scores 4 against him in that Game 3 victory. They lead 2-1. Games 4 and 5 are in Lavelle Friday and Saturday night. They have that nice 2-3-2 format in their playoffs. So they won on the road in Game 3, got 2 more road games before coming back home if necessary. So we'll definitely keep our ear to the ground on that one, see if the Blues, minor league team can win a championship. And even if they don't, you still get to celebrate a championship, because on June 12th, the Blues are going to celebrate We Went Blues Day, which is a 3-year anniversary of the Blues winning the Stanley Cup. Bally Sports is going to re-air Game 7 in their words at 7 p.m. There's going to be some special merchandise offers over at STL Authentics as well. So at the very least, if you're missing Blues hockey and you want to be happy and you want to celebrate June 12th, celebrate We Went Blues Day and just relive that Game 7 against Boston and us raising the cup. So make sure you do that. All right, some other stuff going on in the world of sports. Like I said, there's a ton of stuff going on right now, and not everything connected to St. Louis, but jump to the NFL real quick. Then we're going to hit the NBA and wrap up with a little golf talk just because it's in the news. But first off, in the NFL, Broncos sold to another Walmart heir, Rob Walton, his daughter Carrie, her husband Greg, purchased the Denver Broncos for $4.65 billion. Yes, billion with a B. And they've also reached out to Peyton Manning about an advisory role with the team. First off, another Walmart heir in the NFL ownership circle. Is it going to be any different than Stan, M&F, and Kroenke, or what, man? Are the Broncos in for a long move potential?
Hey, you know what? What we can probably count on is some new Broncos clearance rack looking uniforms in the next year or two.
And I got some friends on Facebook that would actually probably be happier that they get rid of the ones that they have now. So maybe you're going to start seeing them pander to the Facebook fans out there that definitely want new uniforms.
They'll have big patches on their chest that say Denver Broncos.
Iron-ons.
They look like Walmart name tags. Yeah, pretty much. Just like the Rams, you know.
Oh, those things are god-awful. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, they'll do something to the Bronco where, like, half the head won't attach or something like they did to the Ram horn. And they'll be wearing bone orange or something in Denver. And, yeah, it'll be bad. Russell Wilson's probably like, wait, who bought us? What's going on? Can I go back to Seattle?
Please let me go back to Seattle. Oh, gosh. Yeah, no, it's, you know, you look at and the Broncos have really just, after Peyton Manning left, it feels like it's just been a shit show up there in Denver. And, you know, you have to sit back and go, you know, the Boland Foundation was handling it after the passing of their father. So that's a whole thing that is very, very unique. So you can't necessarily blame the family because they're dealing with death and trying to figure out who's going to run the team. And the fact that they couldn't decide on who's going to run the team is why they had to sell it. So there's a lot of things that were going in there that not necessarily were on the field issues, but they've had on the field issues. And it's, you hate to say it because he was such a great quarterback on the field, but John Elway, I mean, has he kind of taken his stamp off the team? You know, he stamped the Broncos into existence in a sense, but has his meddling in the affairs of the team kind of stained them?
Well, you know, I mean, you have to look at it and say, you know, he just was never able to find that next quarterback and develop anybody after Peyton left. You know, he went and got Peyton, you know, and then you go, okay, Peyton Manning, and then wait, who's been the Broncos quarterback? Because I'm pretty sure I can't name all of them. Peyton Lynch and Drew Locke and
Teddy Bridgewater.
There was the big tall kid that was going to be their next quarterback.
Simeon? Trevor Siemian was there.
There was somebody else. What was that other kid's name? He was kind of he played quarterback for a while the year that they won the Super Bowl that Manning was not playing well, and then Manning came back. I can't think of his name. You know who I'm talking about?
I'm finding out. Don't worry. I'm definitely finding out.
I can see
out.
His face, but I can't think of his name. But there's been a bunch of them.
All right, let's see. Well, Case Keenum was in 2018. Brock Osweiler,
yeah.
Yep. And before Manning, they had Tebow and Kyle Orton. Jay Cutler was there for a year and a half. After Elway, you're almost sitting there as a Broncos fan, almost longing for the days of Brian Greasy and Jake Plummer.
Yeah. And those guys were good for a while. Yep. I mean, you know, but Greasy had a few years where he was good. And then, you know, Jake Plummer came over at the end of his career after being in Arizona and had a couple of good years before he decided to retire. And then, yeah, it kind of went downhill after that. You know, you had Peyton for a couple of years. And then, like you said, Brock Osweiler and all the Trevor Siemian and, yeah, try to remember all those names because Peyton Lynch. Remember when they drafted Peyton Lynch?
Paxton Lynch. Yes, Paxton Lynch.
Paxton Lynch, Peyton Lynch. It all goes together. Doesn't matter.
Peyton was there for 3.5 years.
I don't think he played more than 3.5 games.
Though. No, he played, according to this, he played 16 games for the Broncos each of the years 2012, 13, and 14, and played in 9 games in 2015.
I do not remember him playing that many games.
I don't either. That's insane.
I remember him talking about him and hoping that he was going to be the next thing, but I do not remember him playing that many games.
Yeah, I mean, everywhere I'm looking, he's listed as 16 and 12, 13 and 14, and then 9 and 15.
Huh, I do not remember him playing that much. And, you know, we talk about all the quarterbacks. I totally forgot Tim Tebow was in Denver. How can I forget that? The miracle playoff touchdown jump pass that he threw for 2 yards, and it went for 90. And then he was going to be the savior of football after that.
And now he is a analyst for college football and a former Major League Baseball attemptee. Yeah.
Former 35-year-old minor leaguer.
Hey, but honestly, he found his calling, and he does a pretty darn good job in that analyst role. So, you know, it may not have worked out on the field, but off the field, everything came up roses for Tim Tebow off the field.
I got to be honest, Tim Tebow, there's no doubt in my mind Tim Tebow is a good guy and a good person, but there's no athlete in sports that used to annoy me more than Tim Tebow going all the way back to Florida.
I agree with you, too. I did not like him when he was in Florida, and it was more so his on-the-field stuff than it was about him as a person.
Right.
And yeah, that's the same thing. I mean, it's the same thing with LeBron. Like, I am not a LeBron the basketball player fan. Off the court, the things he does in the community and for everybody and for kids and all that stuff, cannot think of a better person to be able to, you know, he spends his money wisely in a sense, and he diversifies all this stuff. First $1 billion active NBA athlete. You know, Michael Jordan is the only other $1 billion NBA athlete. That didn't happen until after his career was over. In fact, he's an active player and is a billionaire is insane. So what he does off the court, one thing, as an on the court basketball player, I can't stand LeBron.
Yeah, I know he does some good stuff. I can't stand LeBron the person. You know, he just opens his mouth at the wrong time a lot of times and says things that are kind of out of place sometimes and misplaced. He does do a lot of charity work and does a lot of stuff with kids, so I have to respect him for that. And I was a huge LeBron fan coming out of high school and when he first went to Cleveland. And then, you know, once he took his talents to South Beach, the whole decision – 4-hour spectacle.
Which if you dive deeper into that, it's actually that whole decision thing was his business partner's idea.
I don't care.
You know, I mean, you have to go along with it. Yes. But his business partner has had his ear since high school, in a sense, because apparently they went to high school together. They played basketball, football together at high school, and one went off to business. LeBron did his thing and all that kind of stuff, and they built – that's who've built it up. It's been these two guys. I think his name's Maverick something. But, you know, yeah, there's a lot of things to not like as well as like about LeBron. So we kind of got a little off topic there talking about Broncos quarterbacks somehow. But
we tied Broncos quarterbacks to LeBron James somehow.
Hey, you know, we do what we do here on the Toasted Tavern. Other news in the NFL and kind of going connecting Broncos to the Rams once again. Cooper Kupp and the Rams agreed to an extension after reworking Aaron Donald's contract. And this is the thing, once again, that galls St. Louis fans, I think, is the fact that now that they're in L.A., this franchise is spending money like no other. They've got three players now in Kupp, Donald, and Stafford that have contracts that are averaging more than $25 million a year. You know, it's hard to feel the winning team when you have a bunch of guys, you know, a couple of guys making the majority of your payroll. But, you know, they got guys in key positions that are making the majority of, you know, quarterback, wide receiver is the new running back. You've got a defensive lineman that is just a beast in the league. And you've got a cornerback that's not necessarily Richard Sherman shutdown quarterback, but a very good defensive back there in Jalen Ramsey. So, I mean, they've done enough. But it just, once again, it galls the St. Louis fans that they didn't do anything here in St. Louis. They set themselves up for a move. And now all of a sudden, they're just throwing money left and right to guys. And it makes me feel a little bad for the guys that are playing for that team because they're getting the vitriol behind it when really they're just going out and doing their jobs. They had nothing to do with the move from St. Louis to L.A. But you look at it and you're pissed off that these guys are making the money because the franchise didn't spend anything here, and now look where we're at.
Yeah, the only thing that makes me okay with it is that at some point here in the next couple of years, that team is going to be old and in cap hell, and they're going to get really, really bad really, really quick. And then we'll see once that happens if Kroenke spends money or if he just says, hey, I gave you a couple of runs. We were good for a while. Now let's spend the next 20 years in mediocrity, which is kind of par for the course for Mr. Kroenke.
Yeah, that usually happens, 20 years of mediocrity. And that's the majority of time they spent in St. Louis. So we'll see how that plays out. And I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this because it's still evolving in a sense, and we still don't have a whole lot of, I guess, solid concrete answers to it. But you got to talk about the Deshaun Watson situation. Obviously, it continues to grow and grow and grow. We had a little bit of quiet last year during the season, even though he didn't play. 23 lawsuits filed in 2021. One got dropped, but two more were just recently added, puts it up at 24. And now you're going to have the Texans added as defendants in these suits as well, because the Texans provided non-disclosure agreements for Watson to use with his masseuses, as well as providing potentially a hotel room as well for these encounters to take place. Whatever the encounters were, we're seeing now more and more that the facts and the events are leaning even more closer to the accusers than it is to Watson. Obviously, you're innocent until proven guilty. That's how it should be. But in these instances, you have to really listen to every piece of evidence, in a sense, before you make a decision. So you can't judge either way. But things are really starting to lean even more so towards the accuser's sides of things. And we were talking a little bit before the show about what really this is going to do to Cleveland, in a sense. You know, they traded for Watson in March. They gave him a bunch of guaranteed money. They've essentially moved on from Baker Mayfield by saying, hey, don't come up to training camp or anything like that. And while we're going to let the courts run its course before we make a decision on what Deshaun Watson is going to be viewed as going forward, right now, looking at Cleveland, they're a mess.
They are. Yeah, it's an absolute mess. You know, I don't know. You know, when you have to look at Jimmy and D. Haslett and say, how can you make that move? How can you make that trade and guarantee him that kind of money when you have no idea when he's ever going to touch the field?
If ever.
And if ever. And, you know, how did they not know that all of this stuff was coming out? I guess, you know, like the Texans, I guess they thought they were just going to be able to sweep it under the rug and it was just going to go away. When you have this many people coming out, it's not just going to go away. And Deshaun's not done anything to win any favor in public media by just saying, I didn't do anything wrong. I don't feel bad. I didn't, you know, I'm innocent. Well, you got to do better than that. You know, I mean, when you have this many women coming out and saying that, and now there's, like you said, the non-disclosure agreements being leaked out and all the things, and Houston providing hotel rooms. And, you know, I mean, it's hard to look at him and say there's any question, there's any reasonable doubt at this point, honestly. You know, I mean, it just doesn't look good. And like we were talking about, I don't know how he doesn't get suspended for this season for sure. And I don't know how you don't give it. I mean, it's the NFL, so we know that they don't necessarily make the best decisions with these kind of things. And I'm a Browns fan, so I want to see Deshaun on the field in that aspect of it, you know, for the pure talent that he has. And I want to see the team win. But, you know, when you start looking at all this stuff, it's like, man, you know, you don't just automatically get to play football. You know, that's a privilege to walk onto that field and play that game every day. And, you know, to take it for granted and risk all of that and do what he did, I'm not sure he deserves to ever touch the football field again, to be totally honest with you.
No.
And you know, like we said before the show, you know, I don't know how you don't give him the 2-year suspension that Trevor Bauer got, at minimum, to be honest with you.
Well, and you look at the Trevor Bauer thing, and there wasn't even anything that charged with or even really – you know, pinned on him in a sense. I mean, yes, there were text messages that came out and there was some reasonable doubt, but there was also a lot of stuff on his side that was put out that made you go, okay, maybe there is a little bit more to this. In this instance, like you said, Deshaun Watson has not done anything to make you even question that the accusers are in the wrong or even that maybe they misread things. Nothing has come out that has put Deshaun Watson in any sort of light that is not negative. And as you said, he's said way too many of the wrong things to do that. And I feel I didn't do enough research on this, but there was a great article or a tweet the other day from somebody that basically said that, you know, Deshaun, his only thing that he's really used is the fact that, you know, he's used his mother and sister as a shield in a sense, saying, oh, well, I was never raised this way. Talk to my sister or my mother, and they'll, you know, using that as a shield is not something that needs to be done. Like, yes, everybody's been raised by a mother for the most part. Everybody, you know, at least half the world has had a sister at some point. And yes, you can sit there and say they've instilled great values in you, but that they can only do so much. And you can't use that as an excuse to say, oh yeah, well, I would never do this because I was raised this way by these people and they're good people and they taught me. No, it doesn't work that way. You have to still go out there and prove it yourself by doing things the right way and setting the good example. And you can't hide behind that and say, well, I was raised the right way. It just so happens that this happened. Oh, well. And if it was one accuser or two, the number shouldn't matter. These events should never take place. But one or two, it's like, okay, maybe he made a mistake. Maybe it was unintentional, or maybe it just happened. But when you're sitting here going, not just 24 lawsuits filed, but the number's up to 66 people that have come out against it. That's staggering. And it just makes you sit there and go, okay, something did happen, and it happened more than once.
Yeah, and you know, it's the dark side of sports, man. And, you know, I played sports, been in locker rooms, a bunch of sports my whole life. But, you know, it's one of those things that you look at and you go, okay, here's a kid who was super talented and nobody ever told him no. And, hey, we want to recruit you. Hey, look at these girls. You can do this. We can do this. Don't worry. There's no consequences. Do whatever you want. Nobody's going to tell you no. Nothing. There's nothing that you can't have. There's nothing that you can't do. And there's nothing that we can't fix because you're a superstar athlete. And unfortunately, and like I said, I hate talking bad about athletes because we know how much I love sports and, you know, I love everybody that, you know, I respect the people that play these games. I know how hard it is, but I also know that there's that temptation and there's that dark side where things can go really wrong really quickly to even good people that the next thing you know, you're like, wait a minute, what have I been doing? You know, and it's a shame. And, you know, I don't see an easy way out of that for Deshaun Watson at this point.
No, and this, we don't have to dive into this because we just don't really have the background on it. But it also sits there and makes you go, okay, where's Clemson in all of this? You know, nothing has come out as far as, you know, Clemson is concerned. Now, granted, maybe they ran things the right way, and this is all something that was done outside by an agent, and Clemson had nothing to do with it. But once again, you have to go back to the dark side of sports in college as well and see everything right. that goes along there. So the fact that Clemson hasn't really had any factor in it one way or the other is another question mark that you have to raise as well. And I'd be interested to see if anything comes of that as this thing continues to progress even further. All right, let's try and get back to some positivity. NBA Finals going on right now. I had game 3 last night in Boston. Celtics win that one and take it two games to one lead. And I think both of us are sitting there going, well, we thought the Warriors were going to just run away with this series. Maybe Boston gets one. Now they're one win away from going up 3-1. Game 4 is at home. Holy cow, Steph Curry is a little bit banged up as well. He got injured at the end of game 3. Says he's going to play in game 4, but you know, who knows? Maybe something gets re-aggravated and all of a sudden Steph Curry's out. This has been a very good series. You know, Boston had the big comeback in game 1. Yes, they got blown out in game 2, but it was in Golden State. And then they had the big home win in game 3 with Nelly in the stands, St. Louis representing in Boston, which is a really weird thing to say. But Jason Tatum has done a phenomenal job leading the Celtics to where they're at right now. Are you surprised that we're sitting 2-1 Boston with them having the potential to you know, put Golden State on the brink?
I really am. Yeah, I said the other day I didn't think the series was going to go past 5. Yeah, we have not seen Steph and Clay have those signature games that you expect them to have, and maybe they're still coming. You know, that's the thing. They just haven't really played well yet. Jason Tatum has played really well. And, yeah, Boston's kind of adopted St. Louis. You know, Tatum's been rocking his Cardinal hat everywhere he goes. Nelly actually performed a concert before the game the other night. So Boston and St. Louis forming some kind of bond is a weird thing to say.
Very, very weird. Well, I mean, if you're a Golden State fan, this is a thing that you have to hope that your team can do. And not necessarily get Steph and Clay and those guys going. It's about limiting what Jason Tatum can do with the ball. Because in the 2 Celtics wins, okay, don't look at points or anything like that, because he had 12 points in the game 1 win, 26 points in the game 3 win, 28 in the game 2 loss. Rebounds, not so much, 5, 6, and 6. It's the assists. It's what he does to get his teammates open and allow them to make easy shots. The game 1 victory, 13 assists for Jason Tatum. The game 3 victory, 9 assists for Tatum. In the game 2 loss, 3 assists. So, yes, Tatum is going to average, you know, 26 points per game. That's just going to happen. But if you can limit the amount of passes he can make to guys in good positions to shoot and really force them to maybe even put up poor shots, you got a good chance of coming back and winning this series. That's the big, big thing. And if you're the Celtics, it's, hey, let's make sure we get open and hit the shots when Jason Tatum gives us the ball, because when he has a bunch of assists, we're very likely going to win. So I think that's really the big key for me is if Golden State can prevent Jason Tatum from setting his teammates up, then they got a good chance of coming back and maybe even winning 3 straight.
Yeah, and you know, they just need to go back and watch the tape of the Miami series, because Tatum really struggled. He had a lot of turnovers, a lot of unforced turnovers, made a lot of mistakes with the ball. And that was something that I brought up when I thought that Golden State was going to win this series, was that I was questioning him because of the just lapse of judgment in some of those games with the ball. So, you know, they've got to go back and try to find a way to force him to turn the ball over, have him make mistakes. But, you know, when you've got those guys, when you've got Clay and Steph and Draymond, they're never out of a game. They're never out of a series. So I think it's still got a way to go. You know, like I said last week, normally I would be all on the Jason Tatum bandwagon, wanting Boston to win. I would like to see Clay and Steph and Draymond get one more, knowing all the injuries and everything that they've gone through the last couple of years. But it's been a good series. Hopefully we get another 2 or 3 good games, and whoever wins, good for them.
Yeah, it should be fun. And the NBA has definitely had a lot, I guess I wouldn't say better games or better series the last couple of years, but I think the showcase and what they've been able to present to a nationwide audience has been very, very good, and not necessarily on par with what we got in the mid-90s with the Bulls and the Rockets and Knicks and all that stuff. But I think we're starting to see rivalries build. You're starting to see a lot of really good players dispersed throughout the country, throughout teams, especially sometimes even smaller market teams. Obviously, John Morant down in Memphis is just one example of that. you're starting to see the NBA kind of re-spread out to be what they were like in the 90s, where it's almost must-see TV, you know, that it wasn't in the mid to late 2000s, really. Even when, you know, Kobe was going with what he was doing, it was Kobe, and that was about it. Now you're starting to see a lot more growth across the nation and more people knowing more about the NBA than in years past.
Yeah, like you said, you've got young superstars in markets where they really hadn't had a superstar in a long time. You talked about Ja in Memphis. You got guys like Trae Young in Atlanta, you know, that Atlanta hadn't seen a star since Dominique Wilkins. And you've got guys spread out all over the place. You've got good players in, you know, you've got players in Portland, and you've got players in Denver, and you've got people in Salt Lake City, although things with the Jazz are kind of a mess, as our old friend decided to walk away from his coaching job and Quinn Snyder, which was kind of strange. But sounds like they're going to kind of blow things up in Salt Lake City. It doesn't sound like that team is all on the same page.
Yeah, so sorry, Mason, Blues Fan Reacts, if you're watching right now. Sorry that your Jazz are probably going to, you know, tank again. It was a good run for the last couple of years, but, you know, that's what happens for small market teams, unfortunately. All right, let's finish up here real quick. I know it's odd to finish up with golf, but this is one of those stories that I don't think we've ever had to experience when it comes to golf. The fact that you have almost a breakaway league in the LIV has been stealing players, star players left and right. Now, 17 players taking part in the LIV event this weekend have been suspended by the PGA, and a bunch of them have resigned from the PGA Tour itself, including, you know, Phil Mickelson, Dustin Johnson, among those that have resigned from the PGA. And these guys that have resigned now cannot compete in tour events or even the President's Cup, which is a PGA-sponsored thing. I know, once again, golf isn't like that mainstream sport that people get up in arms about, but this is a big deal, is it not?
Oh, it really is. Yeah, it's a huge deal, because it'll be interesting to see if the new league can make it. It'll be interesting to see what this does to the PGA, because without the Dustin Johnsons and the Phils and all of those guys, what's that going to do to the TV viewership of PGA tournaments? What's it going to do to the fan turnout? You know, the biggest thing for the PGA is apparently this new league offered Tiger somewhere in the high nine figures to make the jump, and he turned him down and said no, he wanted stay in the PGA because he still wants to make a run at Jack's Records. So, you know, good for Tiger for that aspect. And it's going to be interesting to see how this new league works when you're paying these guys the amount of money that they're paying them, you know, salaries, instead of it being a purse like the PGA is. So it's going to be really interesting to see how it works, and really weird that money is coming from Saudi Arabia and exactly where that's coming from, which, you know, the Phil Mickelson thing is weird because, you know, a month or two ago he called it blood money, and then
now he's taking it.
Now he's taking it, you know, and it's kind of been in hiding from the media this whole time. And so, yeah, it's going to be interesting the next few months to see what happens with golf professionally.
Yeah, I think it's the optics is the biggest piece, is the fact that this money is coming from Saudi Arabia and their history of human rights and what they how they treat women and things of that nature, to sit there and basically take money from them. And that seems to be what it is. I personally have never heard gripes about the PGA in a sense. So it's not like these players have been sitting there pandering to the PGA about raising purses or doing something else beneficial. This is legitimately all about money. And the fact that the LIV is, like you said, they're guaranteeing salary to these guys versus having them have to go out and compete to win the money. And to your point again, what's that going to do to the competition level? I mean, are these guys going to really try and go after it to try and win the big money? Or are they going to just be content to go out there and smack the ball around because they already know they're getting money? That's the big thing for me is, outside of the optics of being paid by Saudi Arabia, what's the competition going to look like even with high-quality athletes?
That's a very good question. And just to talk about how outrageous this money is, I heard this today. Tiger Woods, as a golfer, his purse money made $245 million. The contract that Dustin Johnson just signed, $248 million. Wow. He's going to make more than Tiger's ever made on the tour just playing golf.
I mean, I get it. But still, optics. And the fact that Dustin Johnson's married into the Gretzky family, I mean, come on.
Right.
You're going to have money. You've gotten it's baffling to me, and it's definitely something that we're going to have to bear watching as these go on, because events are coming up left and right. You're going to have golfers jumping ship possibly and people resigning and being suspended and banned and all that stuff. So golf is getting exciting again, but maybe not for the right reasons. So,
right, absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Well, we've been talking your ear off for about an hour and a half. Told you it was going to be a long show, a big show. I had a lot to talk about. Probably could have gone even deeper if we really wanted to. But, Scott, you got anything else before we head out tonight? I know you'll be at the ballpark this weekend. Make sure you guys stop by and say hello to Scott.
Yep.
You have to. But anything else you got?
Yeah, stop by, say hi, dress for the weather. It's supposed to be extremely warm. Tomorrow night and Saturday not too bad. Actually, tomorrow I think there's a chance of showers and maybe some thunderstorms right before game time. So maybe bring your umbrellas tomorrow night. Saturday's going to be decent, but then starting Sunday is supposed to be 90. Then going into next week, Monday and Tuesday, supposed to be around 100 with heat indexes over 100. So make sure you dress for the ball games. Make sure you're well hydrated. Make sure you take care of yourselves, because, you know, you laugh when you say that, but you would be amazed how many people get overheated or collapse or something at the ballpark because they haven't taken the right precautions in the weather. So just watch the weather, take care of yourselves, and have a fun weekend at the ballpark or outside or whatever you're doing the next few days.
Exactly. Enjoy yourself, but enjoy yourself responsibly. As we do get into the middle of June and approach, you know, 4th of July as well. It's going to be another big holiday, another big one for everybody being back out to some normalcy. So make sure you just enjoy yourselves responsibly, whatever you guys are doing, for sure.
Absolutely.
All righty. Well, that will do it for us tonight. For Scott Tobin, I am Wags. And thank you guys for joining us. And we'll see you guys here very, very soon. We're going to have some opportunities here in the next couple weeks to really get some more content out there. So make sure you join us and help us celebrate what the Cardinals are doing, watch the offseason for the Blues, and so much more in the Midwest. Thank you guys for joining us on the Toasted Tavern. We will see you guys shortly.
It's you, man, here from Casey. For all your sports news, catch the Toasted Tavern with Scott Tobin and the man called Wags weeknights at 9 p.m. You can follow Toasted Tavern on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Let's get toasted.